was a lot. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as soon as I got home, I got sick. I have two nieces and nephews out there. So, wow. You know, got to come home with a Christmas bug. So I've been kind of laid up since I got home. But my wife heard the first Phoebe call on January 2nd.
Good. So, all right.
Spring is coming.
I'm making notes here. Whoops.
Thanks, John.
Sorry about that. Yeah, spring is coming, and I'm getting this down so that I can put it in. 1/2/26.
There we go.
All right, got it.
Take a note. That's what phenology's all about. And even though it's winter, there are things to see. We're going to talk more about winter coming up in the next hour with Tornado Bob with the big weather picture. Charlie will be putting out another Season Watch podcast this week, correct?
Yes, back at it. I'm excited.
Yeah, that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, those are fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Coming up, we will bring you Tornado Bob, like I said.
Tornado Bob is coming our way. Let's see. We receive support from Lakes Tax Advisors, where Ron Berg and his staff offer accounting and payroll services to Minnesota businesses with locations in Grand Rapids and Rush City. More information at lakes.tax. And you are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. Thank you.
Coming up this Sunday, the Saxon Bog near Meadowlands has a snowshoe hike. It's from 9 to 1. The hike will explore the Sax Wildlife Management Area. You can register in advance at saxzim.org.
Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com.
The Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Quota Permit will be available beginning at 9 a.m. Wednesday, January 28th for the May through September 2026 season. So you should put that down in your calendar if you want to get to the Boundary Waters this year.
Yeah.
You can book your reservations online at recreation.gov-bwcaw or you can call 877-444-6777. Visitors are encouraged to review the trip planning guide and do your homework for the more than 265 backcountry campsites.
You know, there are a lot of people who go into the Boundary Waters and come out just fine, but there are people who go in ill-prepared and don't come out just fine. Mm-hmm. It's you're out and on your own back there. You don't have you can't call 911 and expect somebody to show up and help you. So do your planning carefully and think of all of the possibilities. We receive support from IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing amenities like their large parking lot suitable for trailers and boats and offering fresh baked breakfast items each day. Additional information available at imhoteltimberlake.com.
Grand Rapids Players presents Insomniacs this Saturday, January 10th at 7 o'clock. It's at the Ives Studio Theater at the Rife Center. See several short scenes which have been written within the past 24 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's astonishing.
Way to make you be creative, huh?
Yes.
You have one day to do this.
I got 20 minutes. I'll get her done.
We love hearing from you. Thank you for the text this morning. You can continue to let us know what you have been seeing. Send us photos, conversation, 218-326-1234. Casey and Warba just texted in and said, keep an eye out for the pair of eagles near the Highway 169 bridge in La Prairie. They've been perched together on the northwest side of the river.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
Cool. cool stuff to see. Make sure you stay tuned. And if you have a weather question, you can pose it to Bob as well by texting 218-326-1234.
Yeah, I'm going to ask him about this lovely frost that we've got on all of the trees outside. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful morning.
I tried to do you wrong, and though you barely knew me, we got the grand idea. You shook my hand and said, baby, you got yourself a deal. Diane, I tried to stay with a plan. Diane, I'm staying. The bottom of Bitterroot Lake. Said I'd steal a plane, dear, and fill the tank with gas. I knew the way to Mexico, and you didn't think to ask. The plan was damn near foolproof. Just follow the birds in flight. Find some smooth, still water and climb on down from the sky. Diane, Diane, I tried to stay with the plan. Diane, Diane, I'm saying that I'm still your man. And I'm hoping you'll wait at the bottom of Bitterroot Lake. Passing over Montana, we picked a place to land. The air became our foe, and you held on to my hand. And when we hit the water, I saw your face in fright. You were stuck and tangled, and I tried with all my might. Swam on down to shore, and by myself I fled. Tried my best to save you, but I knew you were dead. Diane, Diane, I tried to stay with the plan. Diane, Diane, I'm saying that I'm still your man. And I'm hoping you'll wait at the bottom of Bitterroot Lake. Local kids who found you said you don't look quite right. Thought that you were sleeping and the sun was shining high. You know they never found me. I'm on the wanted list. Guilt has nearly killed me, and I don't know how to live. Dreams of you still haunt me. I see you floating there. My love has never faded. I dream of your wet hair. Diane, Diane,
Case Oates is the name of the artist, the song called Bitterroot Lake.
Yeah.
Quite a story.
I thought it even that he was sleeping. Yeah, okay.
That's John Latimer. I'm Heidi Holton. You never know. Folks are still texting in. We heard from Jen from Green Bay / Pacagama saying yesterday next to our driveway, town of Merton in southeastern Wisconsin, and a beautiful pileated.
Ah.
Yeah.
Lucky there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know how far the range of the pileated woodpecker descends, but I know that they're on the rebound. Their numbers were very, very low. And beginning, I don't know, 20 years ago, they started showing up on our bird counts in increasing numbers. And over the intervening years, the population has really kind of climbed, and they're not at all unusual anymore, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that might have to do with some mature stands of popple, because you remember we talked with Mike North, who is in Brainerd and works with the DNR, and he was involved in some research that discovered that the pileated woodpeckers prefer trembling aspen 60 years old or older for their cavities. And there are a few of those left around. I have some in my yard. I made sure that they were not harvested when we had the loggers in. I wanted to be sure that there was still a home, a welcoming spot for the pileateds. The thing about pileated woodpeckers is that they do not reuse their nesting site. So they'll chop a hole one year, and the next year, God knows who might be living in there. Anything from a pine marten to chickadees to smaller woodpeckers to owls. Everybody likes a cavity. Not everybody, but dentists, they like cavities.
We also just got another text in. We'll be talking weather in just a second. Ian from Minneapolis says, good morning, KXC. Went birding with a friend last week near the Minneapolis airport and spotted a belted kingfisher above open water. Is it common that they remain? Is that the last? Let's see here. Hold on. That they remain during winter. Ever spot them during winter up north? Thank you, and Happy New Year. Thanks, Ian. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, nice to hear from you, Ian. Good morning. I have records of belted kingfishers here well into November, and I suspect that as long as there's open water, they don't seem to be influenced by temperature, which is the case for a lot of birds. If they have a good source of food, they can tolerate temperatures that, you know, would put the rest of us, you know, in apoplexy probably, and even closer to the, I don't know, not being surviving. Yeah, Bob.
I was down in the Twin Cities over Christmas and went hiking along the Mississippi River, which was partially open down there. And there's a place I'd walk by and there'd be robins just like spring.
So, yeah.
Yeah. There are a lot of them down there and along the river.
Yep. Yeah. It's astonishing. And some of you may not know this, but our good friend Bob here is a respected birder. He knows his way around the birds.
I'm not a big, like...
You're not...
I know them, but I don't, like, I'm not, like, a famous name in the birding community.
What is the deal of people? We had this in our podcast a couple weeks ago. People don't want to admit they're birders. They don't want to take on...
Well, I admit I like birds and I look at them, but I don't
I think because... There's so many birds that people feel like, I'm not a birder. I don't know all of them.
Yeah. Or something. Yeah. Well, you know, I probably know 100. And so I people think I'm a birder, but I know people who, you know, who go out birding and they don't even take binoculars. They're just listening and they go, oh, that's that bird. And oh, that's bird.
That's me.
Are you that?
Yeah, I don't take binoculars. I'm too lazy to remember or like too forgetful. Like I leave the house and like, oh yeah, it was like there are birds out here. I didn't bring my binoculars because I wasn't thinking to go birding, but here I am. So then like, okay, so for example, the way you get that way is if you're warblers.
Mm-hmm.
And they come along largely when the the foliage comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So like, if you catch that one day when the foliage is not quite yet out yet completely and there might be some warblers around, that's your lucky day because the next day it's going to be foliage and they do their best to hide to hide their visibility. They just, they don't allow you to see them. Yeah. They're behind one leaf or another. Well, is that a, you know, is that a, like a Nashville warbler or is it a morning warbler or whatever?
Yeah.
And you can't see the darn things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just, you, so you have to remember the sound.
Yeah.
You're like, oh yeah, it's just the only thing. I'm not going to see the stinking bird. I'm going to see, I'm going to hear it, but that's it.
I will confess to this. I have been out with binoculars hanging around my neck and I'll hear a bird and I'll think, what bird is that? And then I'll, I'll kind of be looking up in the trees and then I'll think, oh, you've got binoculars.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Why not look through them? Oh, that right. helps. But I am with you. And to that point.
Well, the other thing I have a problem with binoculars is I'm like, look, you know, they're like, they give you magnification, but they also have a narrow field of view. So I'm like looking at a branch. Okay, that's where the bird is sitting. And you pull up the binoculars. It's like you, it comes up on the wrong branch. And you yeah. like spend like, by the time you find that branch that the bird was sitting on, the bird is long gone.
Yeah. It's back on the branch you started on.
Yeah, then you like, yeah.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, you never have any, I never, I have less of a chance of seeing the bird with binoculars than I do like without them. So.
Nonetheless, Bob is an accomplished birder, and if Bob says that he saw robins, he saw robins. So
I did.
Hold no doubt. He knows.
Yeah, there were a lot of them down in the Twin Cities, down by the Ford Dam.
I remember being on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota one winter, and right outside of this little restaurant where I was having lunch with some friends was a cherry tree, a big black cherry, and it was full of robins, maybe 20 or 30 of them. There was this huge flock. They were busy eating the fruit that had yeah. not yet left the tree.
And I see them every winter here in Grand Rapids.
We had 7 on our Christmas bird count this year.
Okay.
And
yeah.
so that tells you, I mean, if we found 7 of them, there are probably at least twice that many or more that, you know, we weren't privileged to actually see.
Yeah.
Enough about birds.
Oh, right. Yeah, this is the weather segment.
We came right. here for weather. Yeah.
Okay. I would like to congratulate Minnesota on being what I think is the world's foremost location for freezing drizzle.
Ah.
Is that
well.
Dense freezing fog?
It could be dense freezing fog, too.
Boy, that's a lot of words been in the weather forecast from the National Weather Service. Advisories for dense freezing fog.
Yeah. And I think we've probably had, you know, we get a lot of hours of just very light snowfall here. Like just snow showers in like any one day. It might not accumulate to much, but over a week, it can accumulate to a couple inches.
Yeah.
We get a lot of that. I don't know if it's more of that or more of freezing drizzle we get, but certainly we get a lot of both. Very, very light precipitation during the winter.
The other day I had less than a half an inch of accumulation, but it came out to like 0.6 inch of liquid equivalent because a lot of it fell as freezing rain. This was
Sunday.
The first Sunday, right?
Yeah.
Maybe
we had
the second, first, third, fourth, fourth.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was astonished
at the
amount of water.
Oh, yeah. Sleet is a pretty dense form of frozen precipitation.
You will appreciate this, Bob. Last night, I went down a rabbit hole and ended up watching a short video of a man who studies snowflakes. And actually, he had in his laboratory, he could adjust the humidity, the temperature, and the wind, and he could create snowflakes on his computer. And different temperatures created different kinds of snowflakes. And ultimately, he had a drawing where he had 40 different kinds of snowflakes that went from one I recognized was Graupel, which we have talked about. And then there were the columnar ones that typically we associate with sun dogs, especially the prismatic ones, the
ice needles,
six-sided, ice needles. But yeah, it was really, really intriguing to see where this guy had gone with his study. And he was trying to determine just what absolutely determined the shape of the crystal, whether it was planar or columnar, and then from there all the different types. And
right. It's somewhat temperature dependent, but it's also moisture dependent. And if he's doing a computer simulation, I don't know if it's good to study these things in the laboratory, but a laboratory can't simulate the right conditions that you'd have in a cloud in various updrafts and different values of humidity. And the amount of turbulence that might be present. There are all sorts of variables that are there that...
It just seems like you've chosen a field of study, weather, that has so many variables. I mean, scientists, they talk about, well, I'm just going to control for this or I'm going to control for that. But in weather, you have, you know, like you were just talking about, humidity, updrafts, downdrafts, temperature, it all has an effect. And then once you form these crystals, you start banging them into each other and it changes the shapes even further. So it's just...
But
congratulations, Bob. You could have picked something much easier.
Sure. Yeah.
You could have been a nuclear physicist and just been, you know, it's just isotopes.
They laugh at us.
Yeah.
The physicists sort of like, why are you studying weather? You know, like you have so many approximations to things. How can it be a science? The same way that mathematicians might look at physicists and say, like, these are not precise arguments. They are, you're not proving anything with a theorem. There's a hierarchy of science and reason and thought. And meteorology is really not at the very top of it. We have to do a lot of approximations for things because we can't compute them explicitly. And so then it looks like a lot less scientific than you'd think.
Well, back in the late 60s.
Well, say that a physicist would think, a pure physicist.
Back in the late 60s and early 70s when I was in college, I studied the dismal science, which is economics.
That's okay.
And there was no science that I could discern. Not science the way I was used to it.
Oh.
Plenty of theorems and hypotheses. Plenty of hypotheses.
Yeah, that's how do people behave. Theorems. It's kind of like feels more like sociology to me.
Yeah.
You know, economics.
Yeah. Right.
All right. So what's the weather doing?
What's happening outside?
Oh yeah. So we're back to the freezing drizzle. So now that the wind has calmed down, I'm sure that those of you have noticed the wind we had over much of December. January has arrived and the wind is a lot lighter now than it was before. And you get a lot of late south winds, and it brings in the moisture, and warmer air aloft. In fact, if you go about a mile up, it's about freezing right now.
It is. That's hard to get my head around.
Yeah. So,
how can it be that warm high up?
Yes, it is. So the one thing that you have an inversion going along, it's not mixing out the fog. The sun is just at a low angle this time of year, so you don't cook off the fog like you would in summertime. So we get these high, moisture moving in from the, light winds from the south. And, so we get these foggy days. And having short days and long nights is also not very helpful because you get radiative cooling at the top, especially at the top of the fog layer. And it just sort of reinforces it and keeps it in place. While we have lighter winds aloft and winds are not just moving that fog out or generating any turbulence to mix it out. If you want to, if we went up a mile It'd be sunny and about 40 degrees, maybe.
Wow.
So 35, 40 degrees. Yeah.
Hmm.
So that's going to be the weather up there. If you're not a pilot, like a pilot with a VFR license, or no, wait, VFR, instrumental flight rules, IFR license, you will not enjoy the the sunshine today.
I'm guessing that even if you were in that plane, you probably wouldn't open the window and expect it to be feeling warmer.
But no,
like, rolling down your car window.
Yeah, you're going to have airplane speeds that's going to be kind of feel like a cold wind.
Blustery.
At, yeah, 35 to 40 degrees.
I have a question for you. This morning, I left my garage door open last night, but I had my car parked in the garage.
Uh-huh.
When I came out to the car this morning, all of the glass had like a crystalline layer of ice on it. Side windows, windshield, all of it in the garage.
Hmm.
And was it accreting? I don't know the word. It wasn't precipitating.
Depositing? Yeah. I don't know.
Moisture in the air just got in there.
I assume you do not have a heated garage.
No, I do not.
Okay. It's still probably warmer in there than it is outside if you keep the garage door closed.
Yep.
But if you forget to leave it, that's a good question. Because sometimes what you can get is moisture that's inside of your garage that drips off your car.
There is that.
It evaporates again, and it will find its way to your windows. In my garage, that if it gets cold, that moisture all ends up in the garage door. So the garage door becomes like, if you have the insulating material is like styrofoam or something.
Yep.
You know, which weighs very little. Like the garage door might be 100 pounds by the time it's done. With all the moisture that's dripped off my car, that garage door is like 100 pounds heavier.
Yeah, that could be. I know that driving through, salted roads.
Yeah.
When I park my car in the garage, there's always water on the garage floor.
Yeah. So it will evaporate off the floor. It's a little bit warmer. The garage door is colder. If it's sub-zero outside, it'll find all that moisture will evaporate and then find its way to the garage door and then deposit. And then in this, when that melts, then every time I open my garage door, my car gets rained on by this like stuff that comes out of the garage door.
Yeah.
So regarding the weather, so we're in a definitely a milder pattern right now. And it's been this sort of seesaw that we're getting this winter. We get a lot of rather cold days then with, interspersed with warm days. And we had that over the Christmas break. This is the day like right before Christmas break, I had 50. We had some days over Christmas that were like down in the cities, definitely above freezing. They lost a lot of snow down there before they got it back on the 29th. but our overall in northern Minnesota we're getting a little snow, but not a huge amount, nothing above average for us. And that sort of basic pattern is going to continue for the next couple of weeks. We see variation in temperatures with a predominance towards warmer than average conditions. So right now, we have freezing drizzle, fog. We have a system coming through over the next couple of days, primarily like tomorrow that's going to be going to our north. It's going to be keeping the mild air in and allow the temperatures to get above. It will actually get above freezing at the ground tomorrow and also early Wednesday before the early Thursday before the cold air settles back in a little bit for the weekend. We have a small chance of light snow over the weekend. Then it warms up again on Monday. Again, kind of light winds, nothing very strong. If we get a strong system and we get wind with it and it goes to our north, we get this surge of west winds and the temperature just rockets up into the 40s. This time we've got temperatures up in the upper, say in the mid to upper 30s forecast. We get a little bit more wind and it clears out the clouds. We can get up into the 40s either, tomorrow. I don't think we'll do that tomorrow, but it's possible any of these days where we actually have warm weather. Or we have one of the, if the sun comes out and the winds come up, we could be in the 40s.
Wow.
But it looks like 30s, maybe more likely.
We just had a question come in for Bob from Gus saying, why does the outdoor temperature frequently drop just before sunrise?
I would say that the number one reason, I have to look at what my typical thermometer pattern might be. But the winds, the temperature does continue to drop as long as the radiative heat balance, the radiative balance in at the ground is favoring cooling weather. So the sun can even the sun can come up a little bit, and you'll see sunlight before the temperatures start to climb because there's still more outgoing infrared radiation than there is incoming shortwave or visible radiation to warm things up. So it'll still cool a little bit in the morning. Sometimes the coolest temperatures happen early in the night. If the winds come up and the clouds come in, if you have clouds, that really greatly changes the radiative balance. A lot more infrared radiation comes back to ground if you've got clouds. So on a clear, calm night, however, the temperature will keep dropping even past sunrise, maybe by 30 minutes, just because the radiative balance on a clear night is so much, outgoing infrared radiation from the ground.
Yeah, I just bringing up the graph that my thermometer gives me. There's a good example of high temperature, low temperature. That's not yesterday, but yesterday it didn't cool off very much overnight. We had a high yesterday of about 29, and we were overnight at about 25.
Yeah, there wasn't much of a change overnight. in a situation like this where you've got clouds, a really shallow cloud layer, it has to radiate from the top because clouds are actually radiatively opaque. So if you've got a low, shallow, even warm cloud layer like this, and these clouds are super cooled liquid. There's really very little ice content in them at this temperature. And they are very good absorbers and re-emitters of radiation. So if you have to, you kind of have to radiate from the top of that cloud layer where you have, we're exposed, it's exposed to open sky, at the top of the cloud layer. If that radiates, that layer cools a little bit and it might mix downward, there might be mixing within the cloud, but you have to radiate a deeper layer over a deeper layer of the atmosphere to cool it. And so the cooling is a lot more subtle over those nights. Whereas if you're at clear skies at the ground, that cooling can be focused right at the ground level, and then you get a sharper inversion. Temperatures get colder those nights.
Yeah.
But it's also a very shallow layer that gets cold. If you go up on a clear, calm morning, you're gonna warm several degrees at least. Yeah.
So if I climbed the radio tower out here, that as I climbed, I would actually get into warmer and warmer temperatures.
Relative, right now.
I mean, feeling that. I mean, or is it just
you could? Yeah, on a really calm morning.
Yep.
But if there's no wind, you're not gonna feel that.
Okay.
Or you're not gonna feel how the much cold. You're just, you're not gonna feel how cold it is at the ground if the wind is calm.
Right.
But if you went to the top of the radio tower here,
if you had a thermometer with you and you started at the bottom, by the time you got to the top, it would be reading higher temperatures.
Yeah, probably. Wow. On really clear, really calm mornings.
We've settled that really quickly. You said warm for the next couple of days and then cooling. And then
predominantly warm this week. Below freezing high temperatures this weekend. Small chance of a little iced snow some over the weekend. And then not much accumulation, less than an inch. And then warmer next week again. And then the weekend after, the 17th and 18th, looks like we could have some colder air coming in then.
Okay.
So
All right.
Arctic air then. So, all right. Enjoy.
Thank you, Bob. Always a pleasure to chat with you. Love the opportunity to find out what's going on in the unbelievably complex world of meteorology.
It's less complex than biochemistry. Look at all those different types of molecules that are going around. Yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
Cells and mitochondria.
Yeah.
Whatever else.
Chances are I will.
Telomeres.
I will never know any more about either one of those than what you can pass on to me.
We had a couple more texts that were coming in during the conversation. Jan, I'm really glad you texted in because I'd forgotten that we too were seeing this. She saw a small flock of diving ducks in the Mississippi by the Grand Rapids Library. No binoculars, so couldn't see the head clearly. Small birds, buffleheads?
Perhaps. Okay. Buffleheads, the males would have big white sort of cheek patches. The golden eyes, which I suspect would have a smaller white cheek patch, the males. I don't know, Bob. Diving ducks this time of year?
Those would be two guesses, I guess.
Be two of the more likely.
Yeah.
We also heard from Todd in Brainerd, who had reported on the dead
skunk
yesterday. He said the dead skunk is gone this morning. Something got a stinky snack.
Probably an owl. They can't smell it.
There you go.
Hey, look, it's lunch.
Coming up, we've got local news with the Up North Report, and then we're talking forest products. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, Malachi Coons is your host for Headwaters.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Governor Tim Walz is ending his campaign for an unprecedented third term. The DFLer made the announcement Monday amid mounting pressure from members of his own party and intense attacks from Republicans over widespread fraud in state-run social services programs. Walz hosted a press conference Monday morning where he read nearly the same statement that had been shared with media earlier in the day. Here he is in Kara Levin's recording.
Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who want to prey on our differences.
Walz did not take any questions. The Minnesota Reformer reports a source close to Senator Amy Klobuchar says she is seriously considering running for governor. Secretary of State Steve Simon and Attorney General Keith Ellison's names are also being floated once again for the DFL. Both are running for re-election, but were considered possible candidates before Walz announced his campaign. A slew of Republicans have already entered the race, including House Speaker Lisa Damith, MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, failed GOP gubernatorial candidate Scott Jensen, and former congressional candidate Kendall Qualls. Republican State Representative Peggy Bennett of Albert Lea also recently threw her hat in the ring. The retired educator and six-term legislator says she doesn't like politics, but she does like serving people.
I'm entering this race because I believe I'm different. I know I will be an effective leader and I can get things done for this state.
Her campaign platform focuses on affordable housing and health care, public safety, and education. Former Iron Range teacher Ryan Ross Denzer Johnson was sentenced to 18 years in prison Monday for two counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. The 44-year-old pleaded guilty in November. He sexually assaulted an adolescent relative between March 2023 and July 2024. Prosecutors argued for and got the maximum sentence. They say Denzer Johnson abused his position of trust with the victim. They also note that he appeared to know for some time that he had inappropriate feelings for minor females, but continued to serve in youth ministry and as a teacher. In Minnesota, offenders typically serve two-thirds of a sentence in prison and spend the rest of the time on supervised parole. 8 Northland housing projects are among the 51 selected for Minnesota housing financing. The agency announced its annual selections in mid-December. The Hibbing Housing and Redevelopment Authority will build a 48-unit apartment building to replace the blighted Haven Court. The project, called Misabe Manor, will be built alongside Cobb Cook Place. 3 community land trust projects were also selected. The affordable housing model means buyers own the home, but an organization owns the land itself. The Itasca County HRA will build 8 more land trust homes on the former Forest Lake School site. Nonprofit North Star Neighbors will build 6 land trust homes in Bemidji and Warren. And nonprofit One Roof Community Homes will buy and renovate 10 homes to add to its land trust program in and around Duluth. Tribal housing projects from the Red Lake and White Earth Nations were also selected, and the North St. Louis Habitat for Humanity was awarded funds to put toward 8 new homes. Nearly $200 million in funding for rural health is coming to Minnesota. The money is part of the 5-year, $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Program created by the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. Every state got some money in the first year of the program, but the Minnesota Department of Health says it got significant additional funding because of its innovative plan. The agency will use the funds for telehealth and expanding the rural healthcare workforce, among other initiatives. MDH requested $1 billion over the next 5 years. The federal program was created to offset the anticipated cost of Medicaid cuts to rural health care, though health care officials question whether it will be enough. The state says it will continue to work with stakeholders as it implements the program. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, Phenology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
It's 8:41. You're tuned in to the Tuesday morning show. It's People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer.
We receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their energy forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward. And we receive support from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in an in-home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com.
It is time to take a look at some natural resource-based issues important to our region. These conversations made possible and produced by Mark Jacobs. Today, it's our new series, Forest Products You May Not Know Are Made in Minnesota. Joining us right now is the newly appointed Executive VP of Minnesota Forest Industries. That is Tom Radovich, along with Mark Jacobs. And Mark, we have to first say happy birthday from your wife.
Yes.
Oh.
and from us, of course. So happy birthday to you. And Tom, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Tom.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on today.
Let's start off with the basics. Tell us about the Minnesota Forest Industries.
Yeah, so Minnesota Forest Industries, and it's an association that represents 9 of the forest products companies in the state of Minnesota. If you start up in the northern part of the state, it's Headstrom Lumber, PCA Boise Paper, we've got UPM Blandin, West Fraser, Potlatch Deltic, Sappy, Savannah Pallets, and Bell Lumber and Pole, as well as Louisiana Pacific. I know you had them on just a couple weeks ago. You know, if you look at our organization, we really focus on, you know, conservation. We want to make sure we have a sustainable forestry management plan. In fact, this year, there'll be updates to the new forest management guidelines that are put out by the Minnesota Forest Resource Council. We're excited about that. And then, of course, we want to see economic development in the Northland. That's important to us as well, utilizing this, you know, wonderful natural resource that we have. We also do have 3 associate members in Minnesota Power, Opus Woodland Group, and then also Compeer Financial.
Well, go ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, we're talking about forest products we might not know about. I think this is really interesting to learn from you about potential future forest products that you're seeing out there.
I think that I've always got to be careful that I don't steal the thunder from the mills. Obviously, there's a lot of marketing that goes on into launching a new product. But In fact, we like to just really promote the fact that there's always this kind of continual improvement in the products that they do make. And I know that when you had Brian Gulseth on last couple weeks ago from LP, talked about, you know, their smart siding and, you know, moving to some different color palettes, if you will. All the mills do that. I mean, that's a big thing for them, is to always just this constant innovation and to make their products just that much more efficient. But there is some new kind of future, if you will, aspects of the waste that we generate. And that's where you're seeing some potentials in a couple areas, one being in biofuels, and especially specifically in sustainable aviation fuel. But you're also seeing it in biochar. There's a lot of opportunities with biochar. There's some agricultural startups that are interested in our wood waste and using the our wood waste to make biochar for like soil treatment. You get much better crop yield with utilizing biochar, as well as using it for a fuel. And so there's always these opportunities we're looking for to kind of create what I like to call a kind of a circular economy. And because you got this natural resource that regenerates, you make this primary product, and then you have this waste stream that you can do some different things with. And so we're pretty excited about that, even though it's really still in its infancy in many ways.
Could you tell us about sustainable aviation fuel, a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. If you look at sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF is the acronym that everybody uses, you know, it's a fuel that's derived from a renewable resource. And if you think about agricultural crops, woody biomass, really anything that's any plant-based material can be used to produce sustainable aviation fuel. The one thing that I wanted people to know is that chemically it's really the same as normal jet fuel. So you're not making something, when you think of like ethanol, it's a completely different chemistry, obviously, than gasoline. But with SAF, it's basically the jet fuel. It just comes in and is derived from renewable sources versus fossil fuels. You know, it really gained a lot of attention back in August of 2023 when Delta Airlines announced that they wanted the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to be an SAF hub. And the idea being that, you know, you have a variety of these local feedstocks in Minnesota. If you look at where Minnesota is, you know, we just have this plethora of just different feedstock options. And then you convert it into, you know, your these waste streams, if you will, into SAF, and then it gets blended at a local refinery to be either piped or trucked to the directly to the airport to replace a portion of their jet fuel. If you look at the demand for SAF, it's really tremendous. Most airlines have mandates for targeted volumes. If you look at like 2024, for example, the U.S. only produced about, I think it's like 20 million gallons of SAF, compared to roughly, you know, the 400 million gallons that's used annually by Delta Airlines alone. So if you look at air travel typically accounts for about 3% of the total carbon emissions worldwide. And so SAF is really a good option to offset these emissions. And that's why there's really a lot of push to go this direction.
Can you talk a little bit about how this SAF is produced? Is it what sort of trees, vegetation are they using, and is it sort of a biological project where they introduce these things into some kind of vat full of little critters that eat this stuff and turn it into gas? How does it work?
Yeah, so that's a good question. If you look at SAF and the way it's made from wood waste, first of all, it doesn't matter what tree species you use. There's nothing unique from that standpoint, because you're taking the components of a tree and then you're breaking it down into kind of the fundamental chemicals, if you will. And there's different ways of doing that to break the wood down. A lot of times you're using different solvents. If you go back like 20 years, the Department of Energy set aside a lot of grants to try to increase the number of advanced biofuels. And so there's a lot of companies and startups that started looking at different ways of making making biofuels using wood waste. And there's a number of ways you can do it. You can generate a gas. There's a process where you make what's called syngas. And again, you got these kind of fundamental chemicals. And then from there, you're building them back up to make, you know, what basically is effectively like kerosene that's used in jet fuel. And so there's different ways of doing it. You create all these different intermediates. I think the challenge always with SAF is just getting the scalability. And so there's been a lot of things where we've done stuff in batches and stuff like that, but there's nothing that's, again, at a commercial scale where there's plants that are producing this, especially for wood products or wood waste. There's nothing that's out there with the exception of in Europe. There's companies in Europe, both in Sweden and Germany, that are able to make this on a commercial scale. In the U.S., there's been more focus on used vegetable oil, beef tallow, stuff like that, that can also be used to produce these type of fuels. The one advantage I would say that we have for wood waste is that from an environmental standpoint, there's a lot of benefit to that compared to agricultural crops, where they keep track of, you know, your emissions, if you will, through a life cycle analysis. And with a wood product, you're not using any fertilizer. Nobody goes out and fertilizes trees. And so as a result, the carbon reduction that you see by using a wood-based biofuel is much more of an advantage than it is for agriculture. The agriculture community, though, is really focused on this. They're doing a lot of things with, you know, taking care of the soil during when the crops are harvested, because there's a lot of carbon that's actually captured in the soil, as well as they're doing carbon sequestering technology as well to reduce the emissions that are from producing these type of biofuels. So it's pretty exciting. There's a lot to it. The supply chain is fairly complicated, and that's why this hub is really important. You've got Greater Minnesota. That's really focused on, you know, bringing in industries, bringing in different ideas, and the right people to invest in this particular technology. So it's pretty exciting.
Tom, what are some of the barriers to developing this potential product?
I think the biggest thing is really with you know, just getting, again, the infrastructure going, if you will, and that requires investment. And so, you know, the other thing that we're really focused on is the renewable fuel standard. So the Department of Energy every single year puts together a certain volume of biofuels that have to replace fossil fuels. And every year it goes up. There's incentives that are tied to that. And so that's really going to be important, is what happens with the renewable fuel standard. As not only at the federal level, but also at the state's level. And so there's a bill that's moving through right now, a tax incentive, if you will, for producing SAF here in the state of Minnesota. And so those are the type of barriers that we probably have right now, is just, again, having the right financial support so that from a business model standpoint, it looks good. The technology is really robust, but the scalability isn't there. If you talk to people around, you know, looking at SAF in particular, looking at all these different advanced biofuels, they would say that another big challenge is really with just the volume of feedstock that's required. And so if you think about, you know, crops and the seasonality challenges, you have, you know, droughts and floods, that presents a real challenge. And so, again, another advantage that you have with wood waste is that, you know, we harvest pretty much year round, which really gives it an advantage by having a logging community that's always available. We never run out of wood at any of these facilities. And so that again presents another strength for the industry. But again, it gets back to just scalability and just having the money that's available through these important incentives, just to kind of kickstart this particular industry, if you will. Ethanol was the same way. You know, it started off fairly small, and then the incentives were there through the renewable fuel standard that started in 2005 in order to support that growth. And now you've got over 200 ethanol facilities that are in the United States.
What are the byproducts? What are you left over with when you're done with, when you've extracted your fuel?
Actually, not much. It's surprising that when you take, you know, there's three components to a tree. There's cellulose, hemicellulose, and lignin. And all those components can be utilized when you're producing SAF. In fact, when they break the wood down, again, using different techniques, different solvents, those solvents can get recaptured again. And so, again, there's very little waste that's involved in these particular processes, which is another thing that makes it pretty exciting from that standpoint, is that you're utilizing just about everything that you have with the feedstock. And so, you know, you're still going to have, you know, effluent that you have from, you know, cooling water and stuff like that for all the different processes, and you will have some small emissions as a result of just the normal, you know, processes that go along with making conversion. But overall, the actual amount of waste that's left over is fairly minimal, which is, it makes it also very exciting.
And then you're a logger and you're bringing in 100-inch lengths to UPM here in Grand Rapids. How do you get the wood waste? How do you get the limbs, the tops that are crooked, the diameters that are too small? How do you package that up and get it to the producers of SAF?
Yeah, certainly the getting the material in the in the right form is going to be important, and as we slowly get into this, you know, making chips and so that way you can transport it the most efficient is something that's going to have to be utilized. You know, these processes don't take, you know, like full stems, if you will, and chunks of logs. It's really, you know, broken down so that way you can fit it into some type of a digester or cooking vessel, if you will. And so those are, again, back to just having to have some of those type of investments at the facilities to kind of really start the process is really going to be important.
You can use mill waste as well, can't you?
That's correct. Yes, a lot of the waste at mills. If you look at the big integrated mills in Sapia, Cloquet, and then PCA, Boise Paper, you know, they take a portion of the bark and that gets burned in power boilers. They utilize the lignin. The lignin gets removed from the wood and gets burned in their recovery boilers. And so there's other waste opportunities there that would be available. Certainly if you look at sawmills, OSB mills, there's always a percentage of waste that's generated. They try to minimize that as much as they can, but sometimes it's very difficult. And so again, there's usually some type of amount of waste that's available to get into these particular markets. So, and that's, like I said, that's what kind of makes it exciting, because really nobody's left out. There's the technology can utilize, again, all the components of the tree, or it can utilize segments of the tree specifically. And so that's why, again, we're really excited about being able to utilize the waste, because there's the technology allows us to use that very efficiently.
We've been talking with Executive VP of Minnesota Forest Industries. That's Tom Radovich. Before we let you go, are you hopeful for the future of sustainable aviation fuel?
You know, if you look at forests, you know, they're in northern Minnesota, you know, they're really a cornerstone of our heritage. You know, they're not only part of our landscape, but they're really part of our way of life in many ways. And it makes it unique. In fact, that there's a balance. You have to have the socio-ecological component to it versus other natural resources. I think that overall, the DNR just, you know, they did a good job of having to do that balancing act. Even though there's this need for timber, I believe that the public trusts us, and that's an important thing. I think if you don't have that public trust, that you know, it would be very difficult to see a future. But overall, the public has always trusted us when it comes to doing and making these unique products, and so that always makes me feel good about the future here in the state of Minnesota.
We have
Tom, one last question from me, or comment. I know in discussions I've had with people about this, they have this perception that we're going to go out and sterilize the forest and take every single twig and limb off the forest floor. You want to talk about that and how the guidelines prohibit that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you look at so the I was just looking at this yesterday. So the Forest Management Guidelines, it's a document that's, it's over 600 pages long. And the 95% of our loggers have been through education classes on this particular document through the Minnesota Logger Education Program, or MLEP. And a lot of them have it available. You know, they have it where they can reference it. And it really boils down to just, you know, taking and harvesting trees that are at a certain age, and then certain species. Most of what we use in northern Minnesota, our forest products companies, is aspen. And I think Brian mentioned it a couple weeks ago. It's like a weed tree. And so we don't do anything that impacts, you know, large areas of acreage here in northern Minnesota when it comes to sterilization or anything like that. We just go in with a plan. We try to minimize